This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, gladdies and poddies. This is another week of LNL. Talking about the poddies, I want to devote a bit of time later in the week to reading some of the wonderful emails we're getting from poddies around the planet, from thither and yon. But one of the most charming came from a poddie who drives a Melbourne tram. So we'll do that. The our international, or our rather our foreign affairs foci tend to be a hell of a long way away. They're, Afghanistan, Israel, Iraq, and perhaps now, Iran. And we haven't been thinking much about Irian Jaya, which is very, very close to home, just 400 kilometres of water separate us. Of course, West Papua is how the indigenous inhabitants prefer to identify the place. And it's getting a bit heated because, as you know, 43 men, women and children are waiting on Christmas Island for the outcome of their claim for asylum. A number of issues are raised by this. Is West Papua the next East Timor? And if it is, what the hell is Australia going to do about it? I'll be joined a little later by Ed McWilliams, who's a retired senior US foreign officer and political counsellor at the US Embassy in Jakarta, and he's a member of the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Center for Human Rights. John Wing will be joining me. John's research fellow at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Sydney, and Denny Yumaki from the Elsham Institute for Human Rights Study and Advocacy is actually talking to us from West Irian, from West Papua. Oh, and later on, we're going to be whizzing off to Warwick University in the UK to look at what an intellectual is, might be, should be, could be. But first, let's whiz down to Canberra for our little regular dose of Christian Kerr. Christian, the wheat export industry is worth, $3.5 billion a year? That's what it's at stake. What maketh thou of the implications, political, trade implications, of the wheat board scandal?
$3.5 billion a year and a lot of talk about culture. We've heard over the last few years this talk about a culture that exists within government whereby ministers don't follow traditional Westminster doctrines of responsibilities, a culture where the buck never actually seems to stop. We've had things like kids overboard, discussions about faulty intelligence that led us to war in Iraq, but all the time we've had a chorus of not responsible that would do Helen Shapiro proud. Now, with this Australian Wheat Board scandal, though, it looks as if some people might actually be nailed for the first time, because I think the mantra here that we've got to remember when we're looking at this sort of issue is that people, not culture, are actually to blame when this sort of things happens, and that you can't have a culture without people behind it and people doing things.
People are, in fact, being named, aren't they? Or they're identifying themselves in terms of the whistleblowers.
We're having whistleblowers, we're having now expanded powers for the Cole Inquiry, we're getting a lot of detail and evidence. And some of that detail is cringingly embarrassing. I mean, the Cole Inquiry has revealed that a request from the American-led occupying government in Iraq to detail all the kickbacks that were being paid was actually passed on to the Department of Foreign Affairs back in 2003, in the early days of the occupation of Iraq. And yet this still seems to only be coming out now.
Plausible deniability, that's been the technique now for quite some time. It's looking a bit frazzled, a little bit strained.
Well, plausible deniability has been a technique for quite a while, but these inquiries we've had have largely been parliamentary inquiries. This is a judicial inquiry, and it's got very different powers. It was really interesting to hear Commissioner Cole just make his own, or the inquiry judge Cole, make his own comments addressed to American senators last week about the political independence of the Australian judiciary as opposed to the American judiciary. It was actually really quite a Tory moment in which he defended sort of Westminster concepts and the separation of powers as they exist under the Westminster system.
And, of course, one imagines the American criticism will make him determined to be even more independent.
Well, it was a fierce assertion of the independence of judges in Australia. And, of course, with the evidence coming out in front of him and the way he's pushing this inquiry forward, the growing feeling that the government has either been gullible or duplicitous, because the other alternatives are just unimaginable. They're catastrophic for a government that has gone to war in Iraq twice in the last 15 years.
Christian, it's interesting that the circumscribed terms of reference have not really stopped Cole. If anything, they've added, they've built up the pressure within that inquiry.
It's been a very cleverly managed inquiry. I mean, the way we learnt that a whistleblower was coming out after last week's whistleblowers, the way in which the letters actually advising the government about what went on had been released. The inquiry is being played very skillfully to judge and maximise media and public interest in the case. I mean, we see people like Barnaby Joyce criticising the inquiry, saying the topic will be in Canberra, but will be known to nothing out on the street, saying it's just an argument for elite. It's not an argument for elite. I mean, these, again, are just fundamental issues of how we are governed. And we're just looking at these very, very basic symbols of how we are actually governed. Who takes responsibility? Judge Cole really asserted himself last week in that comment he made to the Americans, and he really appears to be asserting himself in the whole conduct of the inquiry.
How do you respond to the increasingly loud suggestions from Heffernan and certain academics that this is the way business is done in many, many parts of the world, and we should just shut up, grow up, and get on with it?
Well, it may well be the way business has been done. It may well be the way business is done. But the way these circumstances have played out, a $3.5 billion industry could well be at risk. I mean, it is a very significant amount of money. That's the sort of thing that flows onto interest rates. It plays into balance of payment issues. It's got massive economic implications. And just the way the AWB has conducted itself, whether it did so with a nod and a wink, the way it's conducted itself has led in a situation when Australia's wheat exports now could well be held up for couple of years. This could cause serious disruption to a vital export industry.
Christian, one imagines that there may be a few heads that roll within the AWB, but if we look at recent history in Australia, ministerial irresponsibility often leads to promotion or to a lush overseas posting, and departmental members often get promoted as well when they've been caught misbehaving.
Well, it's often not so much when they're caught misbehaving, but how well they behave when misbehaviour's been going on. That's a subtle difference here, that plausible deniability angle. We have heard in papers from senior officials, quote-unquote, that government staff have conducted a careful review of correspondence, memos and other documents, all those sorts of papers that flowed through the instrumentalities and the department and the offices of the government on the matter, and that this sort of check has found no evidence that any minister was directly informed. Now, they're all the vital words there.
Yes, but you're being theological, or they're being theological. You've often come on the program to mock that sort of stuff.
Well, look, as I said at the opening, people are not culture to blame, and we've got to actually pin down something on people, and it looks at what the Cole Inquiry may well be doing.
Well, more and more evidence is flowing into that inquiry like grain from a silo. And I'm sure Christian will keep us up to date. Christian Kerr, political correspondent for Crikey.com.au, and every fortnight for Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and, of course, downloadable onto your pod. West Papua, the next East Timor, is the question we're raising. Okay, dear listeners, let's think about those 43 men, women and children I was telling you about earlier, waiting on Christmas Island for the outcome of their claim for asylum. Indonesia's foreign minister yesterday challenged our federal government to prove that the Papuans really do face prosecution, and worse if they're sent back. Well, a couple of weeks ago, as we discussed on LNL, the final report of the East Timorese Commission for Reception, Truth and Reconciliation was presented to the UN and outlined, well, the word litany doesn't begin to describe it, but it has to serve, of human rights violations in the former Indonesian province, the use of starvation, sexual torture as weapons of war, arbitrary executions, arson. And we found, and it found that these were official Indonesian government and military policy. So tonight on LNL, are the same things happening in West Papua? As advertised, I'm joined here by John Wing. John's research fellow at the Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Sydney. Denny Yomaki from the human rights organisation Elsham, who's on the phone from the capital of West Papua. And on the blower from the US is Ed McWilliams, retired senior US Foreign Service officer. He served as political counsellor at the US Embassy in Jakarta from 1996 to 1999. And he now works with the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Centre for Human Rights. Gentlemen, I welcome you. And I'd like to start with you, Ed. You've been tracking the situation in West Papua ever since you were political counsellor at the US Embassy in Jakarta. In your opinion, is the situation intensifying?
I think in many ways the situation continues to deteriorate. Certainly the human rights environment is deteriorating. I think we would point to a couple of things. Of course, over the last, actually over 40 years, we've seen various campaigns of intense killing where there's been, you know, tremendous abuse. What in the interim of these campaigns, however, we have continued to see broad impunity for individual acts of violence against Papuans, and of course, continued marginalization of the Papuans, who are not given any sort of health or education or other government services, particularly in the interior where the bulk of the Papuan population lives.
Denny, I congratulate you for coming on the program. It seems to me very courageous, given that you live in Jayapura, the capital. What impact is the increasing number of Indonesian troops having?
Well, people becoming, more critical about their being here because the civil society in Papua, they are very supportive of the of making Papua the a land of peace, and for them, they don't see any reasons for huge deploying of the Indonesian troops or military, or even the setting up of new military compounds here in Papua. For example, we had already three infantry battalions of the army, but now they have added three more, and then Navy will also remove their eastern fleet from Surabaya to Sorong, which is very scary for most of the people here.
Your organization must be under greater pressure. Tell me about, are you feeling under personal or a corporate threat?
On our daily basis, we realize that we are always under surveillance, but some of our workers in the field, especially in Timika, when the Timika case erupted in 2002, and up until now, our investigators are very closely close or followed, and they're feeling really trapped by this kind. And it's also reported that their house has been visited by unknown people, and also some even their house being attacked.
We should point out to the listener that Elsham was a part of the move to get West Papua recognised as a land of peace, and in 2002 you helped organise the peace conference with TNI, police, NGOs, etc. But of course the violence continues. Now, John, you co-authored a report released last year entitled Genocide in West Papua. The title ends with a question mark. You've visited the territory a number of times, most recently in the early months of last year. From your experience now on the ground in West Papua, what might have led those 43 people to seek asylum?
I think it's probably been a build-up over a period of time. They see more and more troops on the ground. There is a lot more intimidation, a lot more fear in the general community. So I think it's...
But is that fear justified?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think there's a great fear for the future. The people are fearing that Papua may be heading down the same path that East Timor did back in the late 90s, where the international community really stood back and just allowed Indonesia to really take matters and conduct matters in the way that they saw best.
You think there's a real sense of now or never from many locals, don't you? People stepping up to the plate in the move for independence.
Well, yes, that certainly happened last year. The main Papuan tribal organisation, the Day One Adat Papua, in February of last year, really gave Jakarta a final warning. It said, look, we really have had enough. We've had 40 years of repression, of killing, of torture, of rape. We're at the point now where we can't see our survival being guaranteed indefinitely at this rate, with the current rate of transmigration into the province, with HIV/AIDS, with the military operations which are ongoing. And this group actually gave Papua a six-month period in which to reassess the special autonomy. They wanted to see change. They wanted to see improvement. There was nothing forthcoming from Jakarta, and so they symbolically gave back the special autonomy to Jakarta last August, and tens of thousands of people took to the streets.
Edward McWilliams, the Australian government is, of course, walking on eggs, if not on not through a minefield diplomatically. We know how complicated and how monstrous the situation in East Timor became. Should we be as diplomatically timid on West Papua as seems to be the case at the moment?
Well, I think it's an entirely appropriate question, and to continue your analogy with East Timor, I think we should look back to that period when, in fact, repeatedly the Jakarta government, then principally under Suharto, would seek to intimidate anyone who sought to express concern about what was transpiring in East Timor by essentially rather bluff bullying in the diplomatic sphere, threatening to damage relations if, in fact, any kind of effort went forward to try to ameliorate the situation in East Timor. We see much the same thing in West Papua. I would add one other parallel, that is to say, just as with East Timor, the Jakarta government has sought to prevent international observers from having access in West Papua to actually determine what's going on, or even to provide humanitarian assistance to the population there, particularly in the highlands.
Ed, the Indonesians insist that there's only 650 people in OPM, and of them, only 150 are armed. So why thousands of Indonesian troops?
Well, that's exactly the question. It doesn't make sense, obviously. It does, however, make sense in a different context. Your listeners are probably aware, the Indonesian military relies principally on offline, off-budget sources for its funding. Over 70% of its funding comes from businesses, illegal and legal. With the denial of access in the future, perhaps in Aceh, the Indonesian military is particularly anxious to have access to West Papua, which has tremendous resources which they can exploit through illegal logging, through extortion of U.S. and other foreign firms, and, of course, straightforward exploitation of local people and local businesses.
One of the things, gentlemen, that we've observed as an Indonesian strategy over the years, rather like the Chinese in Tibet, is transmigration. And everywhere the Indonesians reach out over those thousands of islands, transmigration is employed. And, Denny, there must be increasing tension on the streets of West Papua between the indigenous peoples and the Javanese immigrants.
Well, you see, West Papuans are loving people. They don't hate anyone, just anyone on the streets. We like to make friends with everyone as long as they recognize us as human being. But when you see the situation in Papua, you know, look at the situations with the job seekers here, for example. many of the job seekers coming from overseas, from outside Papua, they can get a job easily within 1 week or 1 month, whereas for the Papuans, they've been searching for this job, especially working with the governments for years, and not many of them could get that. So there's a sense of discriminations involved in this sort of job. Papuan said that even the government already over special autonomy for the West Papuans, but for them, we own the laws, but the benefits are not for us. It's for the elites, and it's also for those coming from outside.
Denny, I understand that Papuans are marginalised in a couple of interesting ways. For example, they don't have the same access to education, and they can only sell their goods on the street, not in government-run stalls.
Sorry, can you repeat your story?
Is it true that Papuans can only sell their goods on the street rather than those government-run stalls?
Well, governments, when they see problems of Papuans selling things on the streets, then they built new markets, for example. From Abe, they moved to Yotefa market. But in that market, still the Papuans sell their things, their vegetables, their fruits, everything on the streets or by the streets, and what they earn more dust than money.
Mm.
Whereas all the stores are owned by the Indonesians, especially coming from Sulawesi, for example.
Denny, you talk about the Papuans being friendly people. They also seem to be open to religious differences, and I'm wondering about the tension between Christian groups and Islam.
Well, for Papuans, we don't see imported religions, in quote, that are coming to Papua as a problem, because for us, we've been living together for many years and respecting each other, even since our descendants and ancestors. And you can see in some villages, for example, in the Berthat areas, in Sorong or Raja Ampat, where you have one clan with the two different kinds of religion, but they still live, side by side in peace, and they don't have conflict or religious conflict.
Well, I understand that thus far the religious leaders of all the groupings have in fact worked together to hose things down. So I suppose that's a good sign. John, what do you make of the statements issued by the Indonesian government following the arrival of the asylum seekers, that the relations between Australia and Indonesia would be affected if the 43 were granted refugee status?
It sounds like an intimidation of our government. If you don't play ball and send these people back, then there's going to be an impact on the bilateral relationship, which of course would be a great shame and terribly a terrible overreaction and very disappointing.
But hasn't Jakarta learnt a lot of lessons out of recent problems in East Timor and other skirmishes? Aren't they now under greater international scrutiny? Wouldn't they want to be seen as being a better outfit?
I think they're so used to working in a certain paradigm, with a mindset where aspirations for independence, whether they be in East Timor or Aceh or West Papua, can only be handled militarily. You send in the military to deal with people who express a wish to break away or to express their own identity.
What do you reckon, Ed McWilliams?
Well, I think that's clearly the situation in this context. That is to say that the Indonesians really don't have a political mechanism to offer the West Papuans. Special autonomy was never actually implemented, so all they have left right now is essentially to resort to military force, as John was saying. If I might, just to comment on your question to Denny Yomaki, I think he correctly describes the attitude of Papuans, essentially a very much a live-and-let-live approach to life. Unfortunately, as we've seen in the past, the Indonesian military often seeks to incite communal violence to justify its presence and to justify crackdowns. as we saw in the Maluku Islands, as we saw certainly in Aceh and East Timor and so on, they'll try to stir up a local conflict so as to justify their presence. And what we see specifically in West Papua is efforts in that direction with the formation of militias, often based along religious lines. Specifically, it appears to incite communal violence.
While we're talking about, we were talking about transmigration, Ed, we've got a huge problem up there, have we not, with AIDS, a really, really disproportionately large threat?
Yes, it's a very major threat right now. The statistics are really alarming. Whereas in the Indonesian population as a whole, according to their own statistics, only 0.48% of the people are infected of a 100,000 count. In West Papua, that count is 20.4 per 100,000, a vast difference. Moreover, we also see a situation in which the health system, particularly in the rural areas, is virtually non-existent, so that those people who are infected really have no protection, no hope for survival. Moreover, the prophylactic measures, which might be available through clinics and so on elsewhere in Indonesia, aren't available in much of West Papua because the clinics simply aren't available.
John Wing, why is West Papua so important for Jakarta?
Well, it's been the cash cow for Indonesia for many years. The Freeport Copper and Gold Mine was the first contract that was signed under the new Suharto government in the late 1960s, and so that has provided billions of dollars in revenue to Jakarta. Papua has vast resources in timber, oil, natural gas, and it's also been a place where they could send Javanese that were seen to be overcrowding the cities of Java. So financially, it's a very important source of income.
Isn't it also a good place to offload excess population?
Yes, it is.
There'd be the symbolic part now, since the problems with Timor and Aceh.
I think it's part of the Indonesian psyche that they have seen that Papua, right from the handover from the Dutch to Indonesia, that Papua was always an integral part of the republic. However, the Dutch held on to Papua right up until the 1960s, so it was never really a part of Indonesia.
Mm.
So it's quite false for them to be claiming that that Papua should always remain a part of Indonesia.
Denny, in 2000, after the fall of Suharto, West Papua was granted special autonomy. Did that help improve the situation, in your view?
It helped improve the elites and the government interest in Papua, but I don't see that it benefits the people a lot, because, for example, in the case of the famine in Yahukimo, which already reported by a foundation of a church in Wamena, 6 months before it's finally broadcasted widely in the national radio, then it became the national issue of the government. So they said that, for example, through special autonomy, they would need to setting up new provinces in order to get the people closer to the governments, or the government closer to the people. But the fact that it's only creating new problems in West Papua is something that special autonomy needs to be questioned again.
Well, let's keep questioning it. Ed, it seems to me that the case for special autonomy would build up internal structures, you know, health, education, civil processes. That hasn't actually happened, has it?
No, very specifically, it has not happened. And although there has been a significant increase of the flow of funds to West Papua as promised by special autonomy, as Denny Amaki suggests, most of those funds have gone into people's pockets, and that often of the not Papuans, that is to say, it is that elite that has been created among the transmigrants who control much of West Papua. But I think particularly the lack of services available to the people, particularly in the more rural areas, is a tremendous criticism of the Jakarta policy over the last few decades.
John, your view?
I think the transmigration problem is probably one of the most serious problems that needs to be addressed at the moment. We see ships coming in on a weekly basis, unloading thousands of new settlers into Papua, and this is something that was promised in special autonomy that matter would be addressed, but it hasn't been. As with much of special autonomy, it just hasn't been fulfilled.
Ed, I've just been reading a scorching letter signed by quite a number of US politicians to our government on this issue. Does that suggest that the US and the wider world are getting pretty anxious?
Well, I think the letter you're referring to is a letter by 10 congressmen to Prime Minister Howard, urging that they very seriously consider granting humanitarian asylum relief, refugee status to these refugees. I think the concern is principally that we once again see a situation in which the Jakarta government is seeking to intimidate some international perspective, specifically the reaction of the Australian government, in a manner that would cause them to react on a diplomatic basis rather than on a humanitarian basis. I might add that letter, although it only has 10 signatures, was collected while the House of Representatives was out of action.
It was actually a pretty good bloody letter, though, Ed. It's beautifully done, I think. John, the Cold War meant that Australia and the US were keen to keep Indonesia on side in the 50s and the 60s. To what degree does the war on terror replace the fear of communism as a bargaining chip, as a basis of Indonesian leverage?
Yes, you're right. Indonesia and the US are now coming closer together with a view to countering terrorism within Indonesia, Southeast Asia in general, and also Australia is looking to Indonesia for that sort of cooperation as well. So yes, both sides are looking for cooperation with Indonesia. So there is that fear, and it's used as a bargaining chip, it seems like now.
Denny, first I'd like to congratulate you for the work of your organisation, and thank you for contributing to our discussion. Denny Umaki from the human rights organisation Elsham, on the phone from Jayapura in West Papua. On the blower from the US was Ed McWilliams, retired senior US Foreign Service officer. And yes, Ed served as political counsellor at the US Embassy in Jakarta from 1996 to 1999. He's now with the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Centre for Human Rights, and here in the studio, John Wing, Research Fellow at the Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Sydney and co-author with Peter King of Genocide in West Papua. Now, we've got the corpse of an intellectual laid out here in the studio on a marble slab, and Steve Fuller is going to pop in after a little bit of music and help me dissect it. Our Little Wireless program, which as you know goes out on Radio Australia as well as Radio National and across the world as well on the web, downloadable on your MP3, interviews a great many people who are patently intellectual. Tens of thousands of them, I think, in the time that I've been here doing the show for the last 15 years. In fact, most of our audience, I think, are intellectuals. It's got this little wireless program has the best educated audience of any media outlet in the country. 75% of you have got tertiary degrees. I think I'm the only one involved who hasn't. I haven't got anything. But we've never really examined what an intellectual is or should be, and we're going to do that right now with the help of our next guest. We're going to dissect the intellectual and look at what makes them tick. That's when they're breathing. Why academics aren't necessarily intellectuals, and what distinguishes the intellectual from the philosopher, the lawyer, the entrepreneur, the scientist, and I'd like to add to that perhaps the theologian. Steve Fuller is an expat American and professor of sociology at Warwick University in Coventry in the UK, and he's one of the founders of the field of social epistemology, which frames all the research he does. He joins us on the blower from his office at the university. What on earth is social epistemology?
Well, social epistemology is basically an attempt to understand the social foundations of knowledge, you might say, how it's produced, how it's distributed, and then to ask further questions about whether the way it has been produced and distributed is the way it ought to be. So it asks both empirical and normative questions.
How long have you social epistemologists been around, Steve? Are you a comparatively new category of scholar?
I founded the journal in the field in 1987 and wrote the first book the following year that bears that name. I mean, there are a lot of people now who call themselves this, and mostly they're people in the humanities and social sciences who are trying to get a kind of interdisciplinary understanding of especially the role of science in society today.
Now, are you an intellectual, Steve, because you make the distinction between intellectuals and many academics?
That's right. I guess I would say... As I say in the book, The Intellectual, I consider myself a trainee intellectual because there's a sense in which you sort of learn to be an intellectual by interacting in various media and getting practice in putting forward your ideas.
Well, that's one of the central points you make as a necessary qualification, that an intellectual's got to be able to communicate. Otherwise, it's pretty much wanking. Now, Steve, you say the sophists were the original intellectuals, but most intellectuals would find that thought offensive, would they not, if they were characterized as sophistic?
Well, that's right, because basically the sophists believed that in principle, any idea in a way could be made persuasive under the right conditions, and what people just need to know is how to master the techniques that are necessary for doing that. And so they were, in ancient Greece, they were typically training people on how to win law cases and how to be persuasive in selling things and stuff like that.
I'd like to spend a bit of time on ancient Greece, but we've got a fair bit of ground to cover, so we'll take that as read. And I'd like to move on to some of the questions that I hinted at in the introduction. You write as, well, a trainee intellectual in academia, which you say increasingly looks like a state of exile from the intellectual world. I would have thought the university was still the breeding ground of intellectuals, or at least the zoo, wherein this endangered species can be artificially bred.
Well, I think you're correct that the university is the breeding ground for intellectuals, especially in terms of the place where students, as it were, are awakened to sort of the intellectual life. I mean, when I talk about intellectual life as being on the verge of extinction in the academy, I'm referring to us academics, because of the degree to which we are disciplined by a kind of audit culture that sort of encourages us to sort of publish within fairly narrow disciplinary confines, in a sense to sort of narrow cast our ideas.
There was a time, of course, when tenured professorships were the rule. I guess now they're becoming exceptional. Did that help this process?
Well, see, when you were the idea behind having tenure was that you had the freedom to explore ideas wherever they may lead, even if they were controversial, because your job wouldn't be on the line, basically. I mean, as we've moved in academia to a sort of series of short-term contracts, people are constantly worrying about where their next contract's going to come from, so they're always worried about potentially upsetting people who might be their clients or employers or whatever.
I've got to tell you, that happens in public broadcasting, where we're all on short. Where we're all on short-term contracts, which
this program avoids
controversy for that reason.
Yes, exactly. So you see what I'm talking about here. Just that change in sort of the material conditions of academic life really ends up putting a damper on the communication of ideas more publicly, especially controversial ones.
Leaving aside the question of tenure, what distinguishes the intellectual from the academic? And I restate that you're not suggesting that academics and intellectuals are mutually exclusive entities, anything but. But, you know, you say that some academics are intellectual. How does one tell these critters apart?
Well, I think if you look, one very convenient way is to look at the reward structure. I mean, academics primarily get rewarded for publishing in technical journals where, as it were, they're showing off their expertise, which is to say the mastery of techniques and technical language that basically only other experts can fully evaluate and fully appreciate. And that's kind of how you rise up the food chain in academia. And that really, what that ends up meaning is that you're basically displaying authority. You're not so much communicating as you're impressing. Whereas the intellectual, in a way, the way you measure success of the intellectual is by the ability to reach a wide audience and to sort of, as it were, penetrate many different constituencies or markets with your ideas so that you get all kinds of people starting to think about your stuff through many different media.
You know, you'd be thoroughly familiar with the term the two cultures.
Yes.
coming out of C.P. Snow, but he was talking about a very different bicultural pattern in universities, wasn't he? The humanities versus science.
That's right.
You seem to be describing two cultures of a different sort.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think in a way, academia is becoming a place where, partly because it's under siege a lot, you know, has to constantly be justifying itself. It's sort of retreating to sort of bases of authority that makes it more and more technical and expert-oriented. And I mean, this is not true, of course, of all academics. I mean, I think some academics, in fact, function beautifully as public intellectuals, but I think there is not very much encouragement within the academy to do that.
You amusingly describe the intellectuals as the ones who aren't panic-stricken when told their presentation time has been halved or they've forgotten to bring a PowerPoint ensemble. And you say they have no trouble making an impact because they can always go beyond the words they've written.
That's right. That's one of the signs that they're, in fact, communicating ideas rather than trying to impose authority. Because if you think about the way in which words impose authority, it's basically through a kind of literalism, whether we're talking about, you know, biblical literalism or the literalism of, let's say, of a mathematical equation. Whereas an intellectual is someone who can convey their ideas in multiple media and aren't just tied down to a sort of particular mode of expression.
Let me read the listener another couple of your sentences. If they know nothing else, which is always a possibility, intellectuals know their own minds. When they speak, they don't sound like they're miming.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, if you've ever seen academic papers, and this is, I think, probably more true in the humanities than in the natural sciences, people just read their texts, and their texts are largely written for publication in journals, not to be heard, you know, to large audiences, which may include students and other people who aren't initiated into the mysteries they're trying to sort of disseminate.
I chair a lot of conferences in this country, and these characters not only do exactly what you're talking about, but they've usually got a PowerPoint presentation with pie charts and key phrases stuck up on the screen, which makes the whole process incredibly rigid.
Yes, no, I agree. I agree. And I think it's unfortunate in a way, but in a sense, part of it, I think, has to do with the way academics are trained, especially at the level of the graduate school, because to become a professional academic is primarily nowadays to become a professional researcher rather than a teacher. You're never really taught how to teach, which is probably the part of academia that is most closely related to the public intellectual sphere. Rather, you're just taught how to spend a lot of time, you know, going through web searches and going through libraries and doing very esoteric kind of research, and that's what you get rewarded for, and that's what you get your jobs for. But very few academics ever really learn how to teach or communicate or even get rewarded for doing that properly.
Well, one of their rewards, or perhaps it's a curse, is that people who qualify, according to those definitions of yours, come on this program in great numbers. So, I've had an infinity of people like Richard Dawkins, who is one of the examples you cite, or the closely associated, his sort of semi-friend and enemy, the American authority on evolution, Stephen Jay Gould. Why do you think that these characters are more successful at being public intellectuals than natural scientists, in other words?
Well, I think one thing is that the natural sciences, in terms of the way in which they acquire knowledge, aren't so text-bound. the way in which people in the humanities are, and in this respect, I'd include most of the social sciences as well. I mean, natural sciences, as you know, right, it takes place in the field, in the lab. They're scientists are very used to communicating their ideas through very many different media. I mean, Dawkins in particular is an incredibly effective communicator in many different media, and part of that
and a very bad-tempered one too.
I agree, and I disagree with him totally, but one has to respect, in a way, his ability to do that. And I think that's because he kind of, you know, when it comes to something like evolutionary theory, he knows how to express it in every form. He can demonstrate it to you in the lab, in the field, in a nicely written 500-word article for The Guardian or whatever.
One of the things, well, I happen to be pretty much in agreement with Richard, but I just think he's unbelievably aggressive. And, of course, the people he singles out for special detestation are theologians. Do you think a theologian can be an intellectual?
Well, actually, I think historically theologians have been very effective as intellectuals. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar your listeners will be with American intellectual life in the past century, but I would say one of the top three public intellectuals of the United States in the past century was Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a sort of liberal evangelist.
We've had him on via a séance. We interviewed him quite recently with a Ouija board. He was terrific.
But the point is, see, theologians typically have to master being able to communicate in many different registers because of the nature of their work. I mean, because after all, something like Christianity isn't just, as it were, an esoteric subject, but also something that there are a lot of believers, and all of these different levels of audiences need to be connected together in some way, and many theologians are very effective at doing that.
We should have spent some time together chatting about the philosophers of ancient Greece, because it comes up again and again in your book. The philosopher is the intellectual's most troublesome kin. What is the distinction between the philosopher and the intellectual?
Well, there's a sense in which the philosopher kind of shares a lot of the same commitments as the intellectual, in particular to this business of ideas and the need to promote ideas and so forth. But the philosophers typically, and this is almost kind of like a disciplinary thing, are very concerned about the motives and the ends that are being served by it. So in other words, they don't believe, for example, that there's some principled value in just opposing whatever the majority happens to believe. I mean, intellectuals tend to be very contrarian, you might say. Whereas philosophers think, look, there's one truth out there, and sometimes everybody gets it right, and sometimes everybody gets it wrong, but the truth is there independently of this sort of cut and thrust of intellectual life.
I like the fact that you've introduced the term contrarian, because I find over the years that they're the most useful people to get on the wireless. You can't go wrong with a contrarian because they tend to be, well, contrary.
Well, that's right. And I think, in a sense, that captures the positive social function of the intellectual. In a sense, it's kind of sort of innocuous. You know, it brings in some crazy idea or some very counterintuitive idea, which in a way forces people to sort of reconsider, sort of regroup their thoughts. And as a result, you know, you can get a kind of collective learning going on, because even if people stick with their original views after hearing the contrary intellectual, they'll at least have better reasons for it.
Steve, I want you to do your Antipodean audience a great favour, and they're hanging on your every word. I want you... No, don't look. This is serious. I want you to give advice to this audience on how to become an intellectual if they're not one already. Because you've got AA has a 12-point program, you've got a 5-point program.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think the time that anyone in principle can be such a person, but especially for your younger viewers, take advantage of your university years as the opportunities to do this. But you know, the first thing to do, you basically have to be able to see things from many different points of view, but you have to also be able to evaluate them. So you just can't, as it were, be just kind of open-minded, sort of so open-minded your brains fall out, as someone once said.
So you've got to cast a wide net, but not have too many big holes in it.
That's right. And you also have to be very open-minded, though, about how you communicate. So, you can't be too fussy,
This is the second point, is it? The idea of conveying thoughts in any medium.
And yes, and we've talked about that already quite a lot, right? Namely that if you're told you have 5 minutes to talk about evolution or 5 seconds to talk about evolution, you should still have something to say.
I can't wait to hear a 10-second grab on evolution. We get it on politics all the time. Okay, third.
Yes, and the third one is basically you should respect points of views in the sense that you should never assume that any point of view is completely false or beneath contempt, because there's always something probably true about the point of view, and in any case, we really never know for sure what's true and what's false.
Mm. Okay.
And that's kind of the thing that kind of bothers philosophers the most, you might say, about intellectuals, is probably that point.
Okay, fourth, this is the idea of opinion as counterbalance.
That's right, that's right. And that relates to the contrarian position of the intellectual that we were talking about. Because this is what makes an intellectual, you might say, different from an ideologue. You know, someone who's always trying to reinforce dogmatically a position no matter what happens. The intellectual, in a sense, is always playing the foil. And that's, I think, a very important part. And that's why if you look at the lives of the great intellectuals, they tend to shift their point of view over time as public opinion shifts, usually kind of in the opposite direction.
Mm. Okay, and the fifth is fight for truth tenaciously, but...
But concede error graciously. That is very important. Because in a sense, the whole point about being an intellectual is you always live to fight another day. And that's kind of the point. You have to be kind of sportsmanlike about the whole thing.
But you don't live to fight another day, because you also talk about what happens to intellectuals when they die, and very often they turn to dust very rapidly. And you cite, for example, Jean-Paul Sartre.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is a very interesting point because in a way it relates to the way in which intellectuals and the academy don't relate very well. Because somebody like Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, was someone who in his day, you might say, made contributions to many different disciplines, but wasn't, as it were, a premier academic in any of them. And so while he grabbed a lot of headlines in his time, as soon as he died, he sort of fades away. He even fades away in philosophy, which is, you know, the field he was actually trained in.
I think he's having a tiny comeback in France at the moment, actually. You'd be delighted to know.
Well, that's right. Yes, I think part of it, though, is connected with the 100th anniversary of his birth last year. That always sort of brings, you know, sort of waves of nostalgia.
That's perfectly true. It gives you a moment, doesn't it, of renaissance.
That's right.
Yeah. Give me another example of the Sartre problem.
Well, I mean, there was also Raymond Aron, who was who was kind of his nemesis during his time. During the Cold War, he was someone who was very out in the front supporting the United States and the sort of Anglo-American way of looking at the Cold War long before it became fashionable in France, because, of course, the French tended to be very attached to a kind of Marxist pro-Soviet kind of perspective until the 1970s, even the 1980s. And Aron was a very influential person in his day, a very respected person, wrote some very interesting books in the philosophy of history and so forth. But when he died, he faded off the map completely as well.
We're going to fade off the map right now, but thank you, Steve Fuller. Steve is Professor of Sociology at Warwick University. His book, The Intellectual, is published in Australia by Allen & Unwin. Good on you, mate. We'll be taking a look on our next at the furor over those cartoons of Mohammed. It all started in Denmark, and tomorrow we'll find out why. Oh, and we've been flooded with emails about our discussions on the teaching of history last week, so we're going to talk to a couple of high school history teachers about how classroom history has changed in the last few decades. I find it extraordinary that something that seems as, as calming and quaint as history can produce such rage and passion, as indeed it has. I think the Prime Minister might be onto something with this coalition of the willing. Anyway, we're willing to keep the discussion going tomorrow. I'll stick around on ABC Radio National for the news, and we'll see you later.
ABC Radio National. more than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.